This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. And this week, as we approach the second anniversary of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, we consider its ongoing consequences. Today, we'll be speaking with a local environmental organizer in the Gulf of Mexico near New Orleans, Louisiana. And we'll also be speaking with Chris Crom on the latest study of the consequences of the oil spill, as well as the level of action or inaction by legislators to prevent the recurrence of such events in the future. We then move further south to Colombia, where in the wake of the recent military and Secret Service liquor and hooker scandal, we speak with people from Colombia about the military culture after a decade of Plan Colombia. All of that and more coming up on 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we contemplate the second anniversary coming up on this Earth Day weekend in the year 2012 of the BP oil explosion undersea and the impact that it has had on the Gulf of Mexico and local farmers, fishers, and people with environmental concerns. We're very happy now to be joined live by Aaron Viles, the Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network based in New Orleans, Louisiana. Welcome to 5 o'clock Shadow, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's see. How do we begin? Can you give us a survey of the damage done? I know that over the past 2 years, we've seen the atrocity of my favorite fish, red snapper, no longer being red and white on the skin, but having blotches of black from the oil they consumed. We're concerned about the oysters and the shrimperies and other places where the residue of the oil and the cleansing chemicals have perhaps had some effect, as well as the marshlands. But you are there, so can you tell us what you have seen?
Well, we know that there's still over 100 miles of Gulf Coast shoreline that is affected, impacted by BP's oil. Some of it's heavy, about 20 miles of it's pretty heavy. It's in the marsh, and you go out there now, especially on a hot day. The oil gets liquid again, and it's just right there at the surface of the marsh, unfortunately. We've got tarballs showing up all throughout that impact zone. The tarballs have been analyzed now, and they're found to include the Vibrio bacteria, so just really nasty stuff that you don't really want to be coming into contact with. Looking into the deep waters, where, of course, the vast majority of the oil was all released out in the deep water. Some of it made it into the coast, but it was all out there in the Gulf deep waters. And corals have been damaged and killed, deep water corals, a very important ecosystem. We are seeing now that red snapper that you mentioned, seeing very, very elevated levels of lesions, wounds basically on these fish. So they did a survey of the deep water fish, the red snapper, and found these lesions in about 5 to 10% of the fish they were catching, which is off the chart, order of magnitude higher than what they would have found before the spill. So we know those deep water fish have been affected. Then looking at the kind of inshore impacts, we've got this Gulf killifish, which is a bait fish. A really, really important fish. It spends all its life cycle in the marsh and feeds lots of other fish that we do like to eat and catch. And they found gill damage in those fish, which is very much linked to BP's oil. They conclusively proved it was BP's oil. And what that is, they call that a sublethal impact. So it doesn't kill the fish, but it makes it far weaker. And then when that fish is weaker, it's going to be more susceptible to other stressors in the environment.
Is that like tarball or accumulation of gunk in the gills?
Yeah, it's this constant exposure, and the PAHs, the polycyclical aromatic hydrocarbons, the toxic constituents of that oil, they were in the marsh for months affecting these fish. And a lot of these fish, as they've been affected, they can pass on some of these impacts. It's a kind of mutagenic impact, so they can pass it on to the next generation. and weakens that fish so that the next thing that comes through can really knock it out. And that's what they saw up in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez. It's four seasons after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. That's when the herring fishery collapsed. So here we are 2 years after the BP disaster, and we are clearly not out of the woods yet. And if you look kind of close enough and with the right perspective, it's clear there's a lot of troubling warning signs in this ecosystem.
About the non-piscean species in the Gulf of Mexico, there is some concern for the dolphins, is there not?
Oh, absolutely. It's what NOAA calls an unusual mortality event, and it's been happening, you know, for a historic period. The dead dolphins are still washing up at elevated rates. There was this period kind of when the dolphins would have been giving birth, and we saw really elevated rates of stillborn dolphins washing up. And, you know, that's really troubling because dolphins are mammals, and they're, of course, exposed to the oil in a way that, you know, humans weren't, and probably were, you know, sprayed far more frequently with dispersant or affected by the toxic constituents that broke up that oil. It is something that's really troubling because they are our kind of closest relative out there in the marsh. And, you know, the fact that they're sick and that they've got interior organ damage related to this exposure is very, very troubling.
Aaron, during the contemporaneous coverage of this disaster that was unleashed by the Obama administration's gleeful embrace of offshore drilling, that we were told by government officials, we were told by executives of BP that this is just a small thing. There have been other oil spills, and the ecosphere, the Gulf, the ocean is a very vibrant life system, and it will purge itself of these materials in no time. And yet at the same time, there was sprayed underwater and everywhere possible a detergent, a kind of dispersant, which some people say may have made the spill worse by distributing it in smaller particles over a greater area. Can you speak to the failure of the recovery of the ecosystem and the damage done by the dispersants that were so much spread by BP to disguise the oil?
I mean, this was a historic oil spill. It was a kind of most significant 200 million gallons of oil put into the ecosystem, topped with 2 million gallons of dispersant. So it was historic on many fronts. And they'd never used dispersant at a subsurface, deep water application. And that's actually, you know, they're looking at it as actually a breakthrough because they did this. There's no study that shows it was actually effective at that deep water application, but it's already making its way into response plans that the Coast Guard is putting together for other deep water responses, which is really troubling. We think there's a lot of concerns. We know that the dispersant breaks the oil up, which gives it, and the way the chemical breaks it up, some scientists say it actually makes it far more likely that the oil and its toxic constituents will kind of pass into other life forms more readily, more easily, because of, you know, kind of attaching it similar to a type of a fat or an oil, breaking it down so your body could absorb it quicker. That's what some scientists say. You know, what we know is that, you know, it was an unprecedented use of it, that they were using a version of it that wasn't proven to be the most effective for this ecosystem. Oil is toxic, dispersant is toxic, and if you actually put the two together, dispersed oil is actually more toxic than either constituent, but it theoretically and does break down more quickly. So there are trade-offs here, and I think what we had encouraged from day one was a skimming fleet that had the capacity that BP had basically signed on the bottom lines. They had signed agreements with the government saying they could skim a disaster of this magnitude. Well, that clearly wasn't the case. They did not have the skimmers ready to go. They couldn't even get the skimming capacity they promised, you know, by the end of the disaster, 86 days later, when the oil finally stopped flowing. So, you know, we think the physical removal of the oil from the ecosystem is the best way of dealing with it, not the chemical treatment of it. But they never were able to do what they said they would. You know, they didn't even have a fire boom. They said the first thing they're going to do is they're going to burn the oil. So they'll corral the oil with these booms, they'll set it on fire, and so they'll burn it offshore, you know, 50 miles offshore. And we thought that wasn't a great option, but, you know, you don't have good options when you're dealing with a massive oil disaster like this. But BP didn't even have a fire boom available in the entire Gulf of Mexico to do that thing that they had promised they were going to do first off. So it really was just a horrific response. They were caught with their pants down. You know, and while we think the industry's gotten a little bit better, there's a lot of questions about this ecosystem and kind of what the state of it is.
Well, let's see how much better it has gotten. We're speaking with Aaron Files of the Gulf Restoration Network. And in the wake of the explosion, the fire, the spill, the dispersant and such, there were big promises made by BP about community organizing and cleanup efforts. And can you tell us how true or false those promises were, and about the level of absence of federal response in terms of remediation from the Obama administration, a backtracking on the offshore drilling, the inactivity of Congress, and whether or not there was sufficient supervision by so-called environmental authorities?
Right. Well, yeah, that's a lot, but I will say this. I think that, you know, the promises made by BP, they certainly have not been kept. They've spent a lot of money on ads talking about how they're staying the course, but the claims facility they set up to deal with all legitimate claims did not deal with every legitimate claim. And actually just today they've announced a kind of settlement agreement between plaintiff's attorneys and BP that opens up another opportunity for folks with damage claims to get some satisfaction. So private claims, folks who are in the seafood industry that didn't get treated well under the claims facility run by Ken Feinberg. So, you know, that's kind of sorting itself out through court. What I do like is that here we are, and it's been 2 years, which is a long time, but it's not, you know, it's not 20 years like the Exxon Valdez. So I think BP has responded a bit differently than Exxon, and that I think is to their credit to some degree. But they don't get the credit they're taking for themselves in the ads that they're forcing down our throats right now. So they are certainly putting out a kind of shiny, happy spin on this disaster. And I think in terms of your question as to how the oversight was, you know, I think the Obama administration had been sold a bill of goods by the oil industry about how safe offshore drilling was. They took a sensible step in stopping new permitting. They had that six-month moratorium. And then, of course, politicians down in Louisiana began talking about the moratorium as the real disaster. You know, politicians in Louisiana are so owned by the oil industry that as oil was still flowing, they were talking about how they needed to get the oil drilling happening again. So, you know, I think the Obama administration was under a lot of pressure, but I do think their Coast Guard, which was, you know, through the law, is in charge of this response, needs to be telling BP what to do or signing off on what BP is doing. Coast Guard and BP had developed some sort of Stockholm syndrome throughout this disaster, and the Coast Guard, I think, covered for BP. You know, very historically, they were caught on camera telling news crews that, oh yeah, you can't get in here, and those are BP's rules. But that type of behavior started, you know, the first day of the disaster, and it continues to this day, unfortunately, that the Coast Guard is covering for BP and is allowing BP to make very dubious claims about, you know, access to marsh, which is, you know, publicly owned water bottoms in the Gulf of Mexico, and keeping the public out of these areas that, you know, that are ours. So I think there's a lot of things we should learn from this. One is that the Coast Guard is not up to the task of monitoring and policing a disaster like this, and we need a different entity in charge or different lines of communication, you know, because we just didn't have the transparency and accountability that we really needed.
I thank you for joining us today, Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network. How can people support and learn of your work?
The easiest way is to go to our website. It's healthygulf.org. You can find out about our actions and activities. You can make a donation. You can send a message to Congress saying, hey, 2 years is long enough. Let's pass a bill to protect and restore the Gulf of Mexico. That's, to me, one of the most amazing things. 2 years later, not a single bill has been signed into law. You know, 2 years after the Exxon Valdez, we had the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. 2 years after the Santa Barbara oil spill, we had the Earth Day movement and the modern environmental movement kicked off. So I think, you know, our nation's attention, and we kind of have this ADD in terms of disasters, and we haven't stayed the course around here to make sure we learn some lessons from this horrible, horrible event.
Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. We'll have more on this subject in just a few minutes. We'll be speaking with Chris Crom of the Institute for Southern Studies about a new major report on the meta picture in regard to protecting the environment, oil, and other issues. And we take a moment to note yet another side effect of the BP Macondo oil release in the Gulf of Mexico, and that is another thing so hazardous to coral, to life, to aquatic species, and that is the depletion of oxygen and the increase in methane. This is a report that we filed contemporaneously on this very issue.
Dr. David Valentine is one of a dozen scientists who recently surveyed 10 miles of the Mexican Gulf surrounding the blown-out Macondo well operated by BP Corporation. The National Science Foundation project was conducted in late June at the height of the seabed eruption. It studied polluting gases, especially methane, that makes up 40% of the hydrocarbon emissions from the wild well.
Methane concentrations reached levels of about 10,000 to 100,000 times their ambient background levels. When the methane breaches at the seafloor, or at the top of the blowout preventer, the methane begins to form a gas hydrate, which is a crystalline, ice-like structure in which the methane is trapped inside of a water ice. That whole mixture of oil and of the methane hydrate, as well as methane that is dissolved in the oil, is going to be rising from the top of the blowout preventer. And the methane dissolves into the surrounding ocean water in the Gulf at depths below about 2,500 feet, and that's where it is remaining, and very little is making it to the surface.
The methane-rich water at ocean bottom creates an environment in which microbe action is depleting the seafloor of oxygen by as much as one-third of its normal constituency.
Microorganisms are consuming that methane. They do so by coupling it to oxygen. They basically respire the methane the same way that we respire the foods that we eat. They utilize the methane, they utilize oxygen, and they produce carbon dioxide and water just like we do. As a result, the oxygen levels that are down there can be expected to be impacted by the respiration of the bacteria that are eating methane and the other hydrocarbons that are present in that environment. The initial observations indicate that the oxygen levels have declined in that area by something on the order of between 5 and, say, 30%.
Valentine says the deep water oxygen depletion near the BP well has not yet reached the level of suffocation found along the shallow shores of the continental shelf at the foot of the Mississippi River. That's where observers have reported entire dead zones below 40 feet due to a combination of dispersant use and nitrate runoff from fertilizers used in the production of ethanol. Still, Valentine is concerned that additional releases and reckless drilling policies could yet exacerbate the state of oceanic distemper, not only in the Gulf, but around the world.
We have not had our eye on the ball when it comes to some of the dangers associated with drilling, particularly at these depths. And we clearly need to develop a common set of principles and protocols for what is acceptable practice. But more than that, trying to understand the basic science behind these sorts of phenomena, I don't, there's no way that the deep water drilling is going to be halted. Maybe somewhat in this country, but if you look at Brazil or other places, there's no impact of this spill in the practices there. And so we need to understand exactly what it is that this sort of event is doing, not just in the shallow water and on the beaches and on the bays where people see it, but in the deep ocean, really understanding the full ecological consequences of this sort of action. And with that knowledge, then I think it becomes more reasonable to value the activities and to understand what the potential ramifications are.
Dr. David Valentine of the University of California at Santa Barbara. He was one of a dozen scientists recently surveying methane release and oxygen depletion near the BP Macondo well blowout. Their formally published science reports are expected within a few weeks. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Robert Knight.
And this is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. And we go now to the national picture of what happened in the Gulf 2 years ago. We're joined live by Chris Crom, the executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies, which has also been looking at the Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic coast, and the consequences of reckless drilling. Welcome to the Shadow, Chris.
Well, good evening. Thanks for having me.
You are the author or the presenter of a major report on environmental hazards in this regard. Can you tell us about that?
Today we released a report called Troubled Waters, which looked at, from a community angle in the Gulf Coast, what Gulf communities are really experiencing 2 years now after the Deepwater Horizon rig blew in the Gulf of Mexico, leading to 200 million gallons of oil being dispersed into the ocean. And what we found was really, despite BP's massive PR campaign, the fact is the Gulf really has not fully recovered from the disaster. We visited with communities across the Gulf Coast, and we found fishing families that are still reeling. We found a coast that isn't being restored after rapid land loss, which was exacerbated by the spill, and which is a result of a lot of the pipelines that are dug into the coast and the energy industry in the Gulf Coast, and also residents who are still reporting widespread illnesses after exposure to oil and dispersants. So we know this oil is still washing up on Gulf shores, and people are still dealing with the consequences, but what's striking is how little nationally has been done to address these issues. And the real message coming out of the report was that these local leaders were clear that a recovery needs to be a national priority if the Gulf Coast is going to get back on its feet.
Chris Crom, we just spoke with Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network about the consequences to the ecology. And you mentioned human illnesses that are consequent to the spill and the exposure. Can you detail a little bit more what kind of human effects there are?
These reports started coming out right after the spill, and it was especially acute with people who were the tens of thousands of people who were involved in the cleanup effort, who were dispatched to the beaches and even went into the ocean to clean up some of the oil that was washing ashore. And what people started reporting, just a wide variety of illnesses, headaches, and it was this long list of health issues that they hadn't experienced before. And that were all consistent with exposure to the kind of chemicals that are in either crude oil and also the dispersant, which was being used in record amounts, that BP sprayed the Corexit dispersant right after the spill, both at the wellhead and over the top of the ocean. And so there was a real concern from the beginning that the exposure from cleanup crews, but also people who were just visiting the beach or otherwise exposed, was causing some real health issues. And the more evidence began mounting, surveys were done which showed lots of people who had been in the vicinity were experiencing the same kinds of health effects. And so 2 years later, a lot of people are still saying they have some of those same symptoms. And various groups, we talked with the group Louisiana Environmental Action Network, which has set up a free clinic to see people, and they're being diagnosed. Sampling is showing that they do have elevated levels of some of these chemicals. They're also still experiencing these problems, but they don't know where to go to either be diagnosed or to get medical help. And there's also no assurance that they're going to be protected in the future from being exposed again.
You refer to the lack of action from Congress in terms of remediation, restitution, and prevention of this kind of incident. And one of the things is that local drillers want to continue the business recklessly, if profitably. Is it a matter in legislation that money talks while Congress balks and victims walk? Why is there not a reasonable ecological solution coming from our legislators?
Well, it is interesting that right after the spill, the Department of Interior and the Obama administration called for a pause on deep water drilling. And it went for a few months, and the idea was to assess exactly what had gone wrong and what needed to happen to make it safer. And almost immediately, there was immense pressure from the energy industry in Louisiana and nationally, who jumped up their lobbying dollars both in Congress and at the state level to try to reverse that moratorium and started making up big numbers about big job losses, which actually the evidence didn't support. But that pressure was so intense that today, not only are we almost back up to the same number of drilling operations in the Gulf Coast, but we're also seeing a flood of new permits where it's almost assured that in the near future we're going to have more deep water drilling than we had before the BP spill. And it's not clear that we have any better regulations in place to prevent that. And it's also no real conversation about whether that's the best way to be getting our energy and what are the long-term consequences for the Gulf Coast.
The Obama administration has recently referred to nuclear energy as a green, non-greenhouse source of energy and has moved forward with the process of offshore drilling, Alaska, Slope, and so on. Are you satisfied with the gung-ho nature of this energy expansion?
Well, that's another form of energy. You know, in a way, in the South, we have a southern-wide research, you know, that we look at the Institute for Southern Studies, and we have the South has almost become a sacrifice zone for the nation's energy needs, where not only the coal out of Appalachia, the oil out of the Gulf Coast, but also the bulk of the nuclear power plants that are planned to be erected are going to be in southern states. And so what we're seeing is the Gulf Coast is a great emblem of a region with an extractive industry, which is bearing all the consequences of the nation's energy needs. And its failure to adopt an energy policy that looks seriously at what it would take to get alternatives and renewables on the table.
Well, I thank you for joining us with this perspective today. Chris Cromm, Executive Director of the Institute for Southern Studies. I assume you're in North Carolina, is that correct?
We're based in North Carolina, that's correct.
And tell people how they can obtain this major report, analytic review of the hazards and policies in regard to drilling and related affairs.
The report will be appearing on our website at the Institute for Southern Studies, which is www.southernstudies.org.
Well, thank you once more for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. We'll stay in touch and stay on this story. Chris
Cromm. Thank you for having me.
All right, this is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We'll be back with more after this.
vapors, and I weighed the waters, my body's covered up in oil. I want to fly home, but my wings are heavy, and these days of struggling have taken their toll. And I am in prison by this tragedy of man, pumped from the ocean's floor, strangling our coastal shores. Power of money roars, and I am at war. I am at war. I am at war. This is my war, and I cannot soar, and I cannot sail, and money.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we moved from the Gulf of Mexico to another southern location. And we refer specifically to Colombia, where there has been a great deal of consternation over the recent visit of United States military personnel and Secret Service teams with the incident that occurred at a nightclub and at a hotel in which two dozen members of the Secret Service and more than half a dozen members of the United States military, snipers and other team members ready for a showdown to protect the president, were implicated in a party that lasted and involved liquor, allegations of cocaine, and of prostitutes who were not fully paid by the people who bragged in the nightclubs that they were there to protect the president. And in today's program, we want to go beyond that superficial incident to see why American military and Secret Service personnel would act in such a reckless and arrogant manner. What is it about the military culture occupying a nation involved in Plan Colombia, marijuana eradication, and setting up bases that might be instrumental in future interventions in regard to Venezuela? We note that over the past decade, there has been approximately up to $10 billion spent on the so-called Plan Colombia and its corollaries. And in fact, over the recent few years, since the past 3 years or so, the proportion of United States military aid going to Colombia has been increasingly spent on weapons rather than social and other forms of social change, meaning that there is a boon for American manufacturers and a continuing plan for infant war against insurgents, rebels, leftists, FARC, and other people who are opposed to the United States presence and intervention and policy guidance. In order to get deeper into this story, we are happy now to be joined by Susan Pimiento. She is a Colombian who has just returned for the People's Summit that just ended earlier this week. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Susan.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First of all, can you tell us what it's like in Cartagena? And do you see the Americans there and the burly military types? And what is the social interaction?
Yes, we were there. I was there at the People's Summit, but it is a summit that is run parallel to the America Summit. And for that, it was heavily militarized. There were easily at least 6,000 army people guarding the city, and there was a lot of repression. We had at the People's Conference, there were delegations from, especially unions from all over Colombia, people who spend 20 hours, 30 hours in bus rides, and there was a lot of harassment. They were subjected to many checkpoints, and once they got to Cartagena, they were harassed by the army and the police. So yes, the days, you know, when the heads of state of the hemisphere came, there was it was the heaviest of military session that the people in Cartagena have seen ever.
Cartagena is a port city on the northern Colombian coast where the United States Navy has visited many times and is involved in the ongoing operations and coordinating the Colombian military in the various attacks out in the countryside in the southeast and other parts of the country. Did you see Americans of a military heritage in Cartagena?
Definitely. There were many. There was quite a heavy security, and you could see even in the plane when I came to Cartagena. I arrived there a few days after the President Summit started. So yes. But I think it's what happened with the Secret Service man. It's one of the reasons why the people in Colombia had so much opposed to this agreement that the U.S. and Colombia military cooperation agreement that granted U.S. access to at least 7 military bases. That was back in 2009 because there had been, in the past, there had been incidents of women and girls, you know, as young as 14 years old, raped by either soldiers or contractors. And then the men responsible, you know, yes, very quickly whisked away from Colombia and has never been prosecuted. There have been, yeah, severe cases reported. They enjoy the immunity that it is really, in reality, it's really a seal of impunity.
We're speaking with Susan Pimiento, who has just returned from Cartagena, Colombia. And Susan, you were there for the People's Summit. Can you tell us more about who was involved and what they want?
Yes, sure. The People's Summit, there has been, yes, after the first Summit of the Americas. The first Summit of the Americas was in 94 and during the Clinton administration, and it was a part of an effort for the U.S. to establish the free trade of the Americas. So that will be like the NAFTA, but for the whole hemisphere. So the social groups, especially the unions, and then the indigenous peoples, they very quickly start organizing, and then they got together opposing such a style of free trade agreement because that's very detrimental to their livelihoods, and they were successful in the fact that they defeated the FTA was defeated just a few years after, and ever since it's the people from the Americas that gather, and they are the truly voice of the Americas in saying, you know, how what the basis of the relationships between the countries should be, and especially regarding the U.S. with U.S. and Canada towards the rest of the region. This year was very emblematic because for the first time there has been an opening. There have been some heads of state coming out publicly saying that the war on drugs is a failure and it is costing so many lives. And I mean, if you see, you see, of course, Colombia with Plan Colombia, you know, $10 billion later, and still, you know, hasn't been effective in reducing nor the demand nor the nor nor the supply, but it has brought so many deaths in Colombia, and it has really fueled the armed conflict. And then now in Mexico, with Plan Merida, which is pretty much it drafted in the same style as Plan Colombia, you see that over the past 5-6 years, you see this carnage. You know, 60,000 lives have been lost in this war on drugs. So now, finally, the countries are saying, you know, we have to look into some other options. I think they are feeling that it is not sustainable. So I think in Cartagena, in the summit, that was not in the official agenda. It was one of the issues that it was addressed, and that was taken. And then the other thing was that the countries were also unanimous on that Cuba should be part of the America summit because there is no reason for exclusion. And the U.S. was left alone with Canada on that position. So the meeting ended up without an agreement. And in our view, that's a success for the People's Summit, because that was also an issue that we were arguing and we were working for. You know, we want a continent that is based on mutual respect, you know, where sovereignty of the countries is respected, where differences are respected and not dictated by just one country.
We're speaking with Susan Pimiento. She is with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, an organization with long and deep roots in Colombia and throughout the hemisphere on behalf of peace and popular people's prerogatives. And Susan, I understand that you are traveling with a young Colombian man, Sebastian Patiño, who
yes.
is here in the United States and in fact is due to speak in Ithaca, New York on Friday, the 20th of April, 2012, about issues of the youth movement in Colombia. What is that about?
Yes, Sebastian is a conscientious objector, so he is coming to tell, you know, people about what is a conscientious objector. You know, why the youth, you know, opposing the war in Colombia, and what, you know, led him to this decision to do it, and why, and also to raise awareness about the Colombian conflict. There are many people in the U.S. who have very little idea of you know, it's not that far away that there is an ongoing war, and so yes, we are traveling. We're right now in New York, upstate New York, and then we will be going also to Tennessee and mm-hmm. to Atlanta.
Is he with you now?
Yes, he's here with me.
Is he interested in saying something to our audience?
Yes, I think he would like to.
Hola, Sebastian Patiño. Yes. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Pacifica Radio, and welcome to the United States. I understand you're going across the country telling people about your concerns as a young Colombian man. What are you concerned about?
Well, I'm from Colombia. I'm 19 years old, and I'm resisting war. Because in my country, we are in the middle of an armed conflict since almost 60 years.
That would be FARC, the Armed Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and the Bogota government. They tell us here, Sebastian, that it's about terrorism. Is that all there is to it, or is it more complex?
I think that it's complicated because it's not only the last FARC, but the paramilitary forces and the army in Colombia are involved in that armed conflict.
The United States and Plan Colombia say that they have so many troops and military advisors and planes and helicopters and satellites there because they are against drugs. Is that
yes.
Accurate or not complete?
Actually, the United States government in Plan Colombia gives to Colombia $9 billion, and 73.4% of that money is just to help the military forces in Colombia, and I think that doesn't help a lot with war drugs because Colombia is the second most producer of cocaine in the world.
You are opposing the draft in Colombia. What would it mean if you were drafted or people your age are brought into the armed forces? What fate, what would you face?
In Colombia, young people have to face the mandatory military service. All males over 18 years old have been go there.
Well, I wish you luck on the campaign and on your speech this Friday in Ithaca. Sebastian Patiño.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right.
Good luck.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. And we thank Susan Pimiento and Sebastian Patiño for joining us. They are with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, FOR.org, for details on the speech to be given this Friday by Sebastian Patiño in Ithaca, New York. And we conclude with this follow-up on what happened in the Gulf of Mexico that has been our part of our theme for today's program. And this report is about the possibility that there have been more than one major oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, that in addition to the Macondo well. This is contemporaneous coverage of what was happening and the discovery of yet another oil spill at the same time as the Macondo disaster.
A private organization known as Sky Truth has been independently monitoring the Gulf of Mexico oil spill using satellites and other technologies. They were the first to note what appears to be a second visible leak or spill in the Gulf. WBAI's Robert Knight spoke with Sky Truth founder and president John Amos.
When the events of April 20th began unfolding, what did you discover?
It became pretty clear to us that that fire wasn't just the 700,000 gallons or so of diesel fuel that they reported on board to fuel the rig. It had to be fed by a much larger source of fuel, and we speculated that was oil and gas actually coming from the well.
As you watched the surface component of the leak from the Deepwater Horizon, I recall that in the early days, you also mentioned almost en passant a second source of oil a little bit to the west of it in the Gulf. Is there more than one leak in the Gulf today?
We're not quite sure yet, but one thing that has happened as a consequence of this BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill is that we're getting an abundance of satellite image coverage of this piece of the ocean like we've never had before. And there are many active oil and gas platforms and pipelines in this area. And back on May 15th, we had noticed what appeared to be a very small potential oil leak, but persistent day in and day out. We saw what appeared to be a small oil slick next to the known location of a platform that was installed back in 1984. So we began to suspect that perhaps there was a small chronic leak from this platform. Possibly there are other explanations for that, that we can't determine definitively just from looking at it from space.
Part of our coverage of the BP Macondo oil volcano at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, which was produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. Thank you for listening, and you may always tune in for real-time coverage at stream.wbai.org. And we welcome your comments at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Upon the sand and hill, oil. Swim. climbing across our ocean floor. I don't want to see anymore. We're walking this world hand in hand. Eve asked Adam, what do we do?